Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today I have with me Samir Singh. Samir is the creator and educator at Breadcrumb.vc, an applied networks effects course. He is an Atomico angel and a venture partner with Speed Invest. If you want to hear more about Samir's background, do check out our primer episode. In today's episode, we talk about what network effects actually are and why they're important, why Be Real fell off a cliff last year, what investors and founders get wrong about network effects, and why Samir prefers missionary over mercenary founders. This is a great episode. You're not going to want to miss a second of it. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I have Samir Singh. Samir is a creator, educator, networks effects advisor at Breadcrumb VC. He is also an Atomico angel and venture partner with Speed Invest. If you want to get a bit of background about Samir, do listen to our primer episode, which you can find on Nothing Ventured on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you search for your podcast. Samir, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Arish.
Awesome. Well, let's dive straight in. We talked quite a fair amount about network effects during your primer, but I want to dig a bit deeper, right? So I appreciate you have a whole course on this, and I don't want to completely decimate your IP, but can you give us a summary of what network effects, I'm going to call them NFX moving forward, maybe for ease, what they are and why they're important in marketplace and consumer businesses?
Well, the basic definition of it is that the addition of a user increases the value or utility of the product for all users. That's the basic definition of a network effect. In practice, what that means is that the core product is an interaction between two or more users. Right? That relationship is the core product. So that would apply to a social network. It would apply to a marketplace. It would apply to a collaboration tool like Slack. There's lots of different areas that you might see. Even Carter has network effects, right? Sorry, what was the next question?
Yeah, so why are they important and what is this? Yeah, right. What is the summary? Yeah,
the importance of them comes down to the fact that it gives you two really big advantages. Mm-hmm. One is it makes your business, massively scalable in the best case scenario, which means users are going to get more and more valuable over time. So unit economics, when you start making money, should get better and better over time. Of course, there's exceptions to this. If you have weak network effects, it might not sort of pan out. The second benefit is defensibility. Strong network effects are probably the strongest form of defensibility that you can have. And again, there's a spectrum here. You can have weak network effects as well. But if you get both of those right, they can lead to super outsized outcomes.
Effectively, you're crowding out other players from the space because you are
essentially nobody can compete with you because you have the most valuable product. So Airbnb being like the classic winner-take-all model. Like there's nobody else doing what Airbnb does because it's fundamentally not possible to compete with them. And based on this, the VC firm NFX just ran some numbers and they figured out that since 95, of all the companies that have reached $1 billion in value, 35% of them had network effects, which seems like a lot, right? But those companies account for 70% of the total value.
Amazing.
So just in terms of the amount of value creation that has happened over the last 30 years, network effects have been at the center of them. And fundamentally, I still don't think most people understand a lot about them outside of this basic construct of what the network effect is. And they're often confused with virality. They're confused with, straightforward inventory carrying businesses. There's lots and lots of confusion as to what they are. But when you drill down into what a network effect is, when it's strong and provided the execution was right, it's almost sort of a bulletproof way to build a valuable company.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. In fact, one of the questions I have is, okay, you just mentioned that a lot of people get confused with virality, et cetera, et cetera. So what are the challenges when building a business reliant on network effects? And what do founders and indeed investors get wrong about network effects? Like how do they, how do they differentiate between a business that has maybe strong virality, but not network effects or vice versa?
Well, the easy answer is the vast majority of founders and investors don't. I cannot tell you the number of pitches I've received both from founders and from other investors going, hey, this is a network effects company, and essentially it's not. The definition of virality is that users spread the word about the product in process of using it. Mm-hmm. And so, in some vague way, it sort of looks like a network effect. It's sort of, people associate network effect with growth.
Yeah.
And so they essentially go, this company has product-led growth, but therefore it has network effect, which is not true. And there's other companies that sort of look like marketplaces, but they're carrying their own inventory, like gorillas, right? Lots of people said, oh, this is the next great marketplace. No, sorry, it's not a marketplace. There's no seller there. They're the seller.
Yeah.
And so that's essentially the same as Tesco. It's just that they have an app.
Yeah.
They only have an app to sell stuff.
You heard it here first. Gorillas is just like Tesco.
And yeah, so that's a recurring problem. But even when you do sort of correctly identify that this is a network effect business, a really common pitfall, especially among generalist investors who are sort of backing founders in the space, is that you push for growth too early. Mm-hmm. Because you go, if it's growing, it's working. That is categorically not true at pre-seed and seed. Essentially, if you want a network effect business to work, you first need to establish strong engagement and or retention within that early customer base. At that point, growth is not important. If you have a flat user base, that is fine. If there's enough users there for you to have a liquid network and you have strong engagement, that is fine. That's a great starting point. Do not push for growth before your engagement and retention looks like it's in the right place. And repeatedly, I've seen this pattern where, and this often happens when it's a pre-seed founder who's sort of building a marketplace or a network, and he's hired a generalist investor on board, and they go, right, to raise your next round, you need to be growing at this percent month on month. Terrible advice. That is not what you should be doing as a marketplace or network. Fundamentally, your engagement and retention and what that looks like will be different for different types of products. Mm-hmm. That should be especially strong. It's only when you get that right, when you have your minimum viable network, that's when you can start to scale this thing, and that's when you can start to grow. And so if I look at my most successful investment so far, at least in terms of traction, Hubbard and Smitten, they both had 5,000 monthly active users when I invested. The user base was flat. Mm-hmm. The monthly active user base was not growing. Their engagement was through the roof. And the ingredients were there. Whenever they wanted to grow this thing, they could. You just had to fix a few things on the onboarding flow, the product, essentially put some effort into your GTM, and it would grow. And it did.
Mm-hmm. And I guess a related question then, right? So what sort of metrics, what sort of KPIs should network effects founders and indeed investors be looking at? What are the core things that are important, right? Is it retention? Is it engagement? Is it monthly active users? Is it something else altogether?
The one rule you need to follow there is that activity needs to outpace adoption. So as a company grows, essentially what you should be looking at is your cohorts, right? So that's retention cohorts, but also engagement cohorts. But when you're looking at a pre-seed seed company, you don't have enough data for cohorts to form. So a hack there is to look at the average engagement per user. So let's say it's a social network like Snapchat, right? The core interaction in that is sending a disappearing photo to somebody else. Mm. So number of photos sent per user per day or per week, how is that changing? As you get more users, the network should get more valuable, which means users should be doing more.
Mm-hmm.
That means the number of photos sent should be going up.
Not only the total volume, but per user.
Yeah. Exactly, per user. So that's when you know the interaction is actually working. Mm-hmm. Because let's say you've gone from, I don't know, 3,000 monthly active users to 15,000 monthly active users, but the average picture sent per user has gone down from 5 to 4 or to 3. Fundamentally, something's not working.
Yeah, engagement's dropped off.
Yeah, and so you've added more users, but nothing's happened. So what happened to your network effect? Yeah. It means the interaction's not working.
Yeah, is that actually leads to an interesting question. Like, are there businesses where network effects effectively then can have an opposite effect? Like, I get the feeling, especially with some social networks, especially social networks that are very focused on a particular niche or cohort, as the user base grows and you get more and more users, potentially not that core kind of cohort of users that really, you know, evangelize the product from day one, really loved it, started using it. But the more users you get, and potentially you get bad actors, you potentially get sort of, you know, negative nodes almost, you know, cropping up, which depletes from the experience. Does that ever happen? Or is that
essentially an execution failure, right? So if one of the big parts about building a network is that the users effectively are part of the product. Right. Mm-hmm. So which users come onto the product is a decision you need to make as a founder. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you found, let's say, a great cohort of early adopters who love this product, who that solves a huge problem for them. What's the next cohort? You need to make a conscious decision about what kind of users those are. You know, sometimes it'll happen accidentally where some types of users show up and it doesn't work for them. then you learn from that and you stop going after those users and go after the users that it does make sense for. And of course, bad actors are essentially a curation mechanism. If you, that's a curation problem. If they come onto the product, you're not able to keep them away. You need to create some sort of mechanism within the product to sort of get them out. So either that's, you know, things like basic things like likes and shares, which is called community curation, or essentially you're essentially weeding them out yourself, which is more manual. There's sort of multiple mechanisms you can use that come into play at different stages of your growth. But essentially that's on you to ensure it doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I asked that question, I'm thinking very specifically about sort of Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, especially, right? Where actually a usage of Facebook seems to be dropping. You know, even Be Real, you know, fell off a cliff at the end of at the end of last year in terms of its users and so on. So what is it? I guess the question I'm trying to drive at maybe is there a point in the life cycle where that growth does either plateau or drop off? And what is it that potentially drives that sort of drop off?
So if you look at Facebook and Be Real, I think they're two fundamentally different drivers there.
Yeah.
With Facebook, it's more straightforward. There's a concept called network pollution in social networks. It's a kind of negative network effect. Mm-hmm. Basically, what happens is once the amount of content in your feed grows beyond a point, irrelevant content makes it harder to find relevant content. So, you know, posts from your grandma or your great-grand-aunt are drowning out posts from your friends. Now, to some extent, the algorithm is going to solve that, which is one mechanism of curation. But if in that process that has driven away more positive participants, that's more and more hard to fix at that point, right? So I think what's happened with Facebook is that the younger generation has never adopted it.
Yeah.
So essentially, the generation that adopted it is basically stuck with it, and a few of them are starting to drop off into Instagram and other posts. So that's a more fundamental sort of curation network pollution issue. It's the construct of the network. And over a long time scale, that potentially could happen to a social network.
And of course, Facebook is, whatever, 25 plus years. Yeah.
Be Real is a fundamentally different issue. There's a concept that I talk about in the course called the spontaneous togetherness problem, which is when you're trying to get people to engage together
in real time.
In real time, in sort of a spontaneous mechanism. And it's not like a scheduled thing like Skype, right? Where you go, or you know, we've scheduled this podcast and we're having this engagement. Like, this is fine. But all of a sudden, hey, take a picture to see your friends. There's been a couple of social networks built on that concept. Meerkat, Periscope, Houseparty. The original iteration of Clubhouse actually managed to fix that issue. They had a different issue. but Be Real kind of fell into essentially the same trap. So if you look at both Houseparty and Be Real, either you send people lots of notifications to ensure that you know, they tap on one of those and then
it becomes annoying and people start, or
you just send them one notification and you don't have enough engagement in the app.
Mm.
So essentially that's kind of what's happened with Be Real. Most people aren't doing anything interesting when the notification shows up. And so fundamentally with products like that, once you essentially gain initial critical mass, you need to essentially pivot or reorient the product towards something else.
Mm-hmm.
And none of those products have ever managed to do that because that's hard.
Mm.
I think that's the core of the issue. The interaction itself is challenging.
Yeah, it's in a way, in trying to have constructed something that was meant to be natural and sort of spontaneous, they've actually gone the other way because people are then struggling with being natural or spontaneous in the moment.
And interesting at the same time.
Right? Which is the whole point, you know, which is why you see Instagram, posts, which, you know, which show the reality versus the photo, right? Like people like to construct the situation and show themselves in a certain way. And I think that becomes harder. Not that I've ever used Be Real, so
Instagram's, that construct of Instagram of having the perfect picture, it does create avenues for startups to disrupt them, but the interaction you use to disrupt them needs to be one that is actually scalable. And so that's always challenging.
Yeah. So a little bit of a sidebar. So we're recording this about 4 or 5 days after the collapse of SVB. Was that collapse a result of network effects working essentially in reverse?
It's an interesting question. I probably wouldn't say so. I'm very pedantic about network effects. The specific definition is the value of a product increases as you add more users. I mean, there's no product here. Essentially, what we're talking about is word of mouth.
So it's virality.
You might say virality is the cause for SVB's collapse. It was the first bank run in the era of social media. Word spreads very quickly. So that's sort of an interesting dynamic, but no, not a network effect problem.
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to trash that thesis and throw it in the bin. But look, let's talk about Breadcrumb for a second, right? Just to change tack a little bit. What was it? I mean, you talked a little bit about the genesis during the primer episode, right? You were writing a blog and then you moved on and turned it into a course. But fundamentally, there must have been something that drove you to start that blog in the first place. I mean, were you just sort of writing for yourself, were you, and then essentially found that others were interested, or how did that all kind of come about, and where do you see it going?
I've read James Currier's NFX essays for quite a while. I've read sort of a couple of other marketplace investors I think of really highly, like Jeff Jordan, for example, Josh Breinlinger. And so I've always been amazed at the level of clarity in their posts, right? But essentially, when I started thinking about the kind of companies or the kind of problems that, for example, App Annie customers were facing, I felt like a lot of the stuff I read didn't really answer them, or at least not to a specific enough degree. So I was like, okay, maybe there's a couple of things that I've learned that I can write about, and just to make it really easy for founders to apply these frameworks to their companies, to real-world context, not just from a theoretical point of view. And so that was the genesis of the first couple of essays. And every time I wrote something, that opened up a new question. Well, what about this? And so I was like, okay, I need to think about how this works. And I had some sort of ideas that weren't quite well-formed, but when you write, you kind of put your thoughts in order, right? That helps. And sort of one post essentially led to the other. And like, I had no idea that I was going to essentially write 24 or 25 essays about this. I thought I'd write like two or three. But that then sort of just flowed out from each other. And so right now, I still write, but I write whenever there's something new to write about. I'm not a big fan of
pushing writing for the sake of it.
When I have some value to add, I will. So when during the whole Web3 craze, a lot of people are like, yeah, these are the new forms of network effect. These are the future of the internet and stuff like that. So there was some accuracies and there are a lot of inaccuracies. So
well, let's talk about that for a second, right? Because obviously the whole fundamental premise around Web3 was you are creating essentially decentralized, right, node-to-node kind of businesses or applications or whatever you want to call it. Obviously, the most essential part of that ultimately was sort of the creation of a DAO, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, a decentralized autonomous organization. So what do they get wrong about network effects effectively?
Well, I think the first thing is, I mean, there's a lot of confusion of what network effects were. I mean, putting a chat group together does not create a network effect. Mm. Like our WhatsApp groups don't have network effects, probably because, you know, once you get past 50, it becomes a bit unmanageable. Mm. And so your network effects, quote unquote, peter out very, very quickly.
Yeah. People disengage.
So that's sort of a more basic construct. But at an even more basic level than that, decentralization is a great ethos, right? It's a great ideology. You're trying to break up companies that might have too much power over your lives. Fantastic, great. That doesn't necessarily mean that's solving a problem. And that was missing in this whole Web3 wave. Nobody was actually focused on what problem they were solving for.
Yeah, they wanted the philosophy. The philosophy was,
yeah, we have this philosophy and therefore we've got a decentralized social network. I mean, big whoop, who cares? Everyone who's fascinated with Web3 cares. That's not a huge group of people. You're not going to build a successful company based off of that. Mm. And I think that problem plagued at least pretty much every Web3 company that I've seen. When I say Web3, I mean the company itself is decentralized, or the project itself is decentralized. There's a couple of interesting companies in that ecosystem, like Dune Analytics, I'm a huge fan of, because if the bet is that crypto continues to exist and evolve long-term, you want to study this ecosystem. There's other people building SQL queries for data that you might want to see. Like, I've used it personally. Like, it's basically GitHub for crypto data. So I love that company. But like the actual core Web3 applications themselves, so far I haven't seen anything that's useful.
And in fact, in the social network space, we had Mastodon, which obviously became a bit of a craze when Twitter looked like it was imploding a little bit, but actually hasn't managed to get, you know, get the traction that it was looking for.
And then outside of this, there was also this whole construct of tokens being used to bootstrap networks, which, I mean, I found that discussion completely hilarious, to be honest, because the whole reason a network works is because who the users are is important to the network. Initial users you get on are the ones who care deeply about the problem you're solving, and therefore they increase the value of the network. Mm. Just giving people giving a random person a token and getting them on the network doesn't increase the value of the network if they do not care about the problem. And when you're giving people giving tokens away, essentially the kind of people you're attracting are, you know, we kind of have this subgroup within the Web3 ecosystem, unfortunately, that are, it's fairly scammy and it's fairly
pulling, sort of, et cetera.
And it's largely based on financial engineering and financial upside and speculation, basically. So you're inviting a bunch of speculators into your product. That's not going to increase the value of your network. Essentially, what's going to happen?
That's what
happens. On a lot of these products, basically, tend to have these massive collapses very rapidly after they launch, and that's all down to this problem of you're incentivizing adoption. Adoption needs to be incentivized by the problem you're solving, not by your token.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. But we were talking about Breadcrumb. So where do you see Breadcrumb going now? So you don't want to keep creating content for the sake of content. So and only start sort of writing, you know, where you see a new issue that you've had. So yeah, but where do you see Breadcrumb going?
I mean, essentially, I think of it as a resource for learning about network effects, right? A lot of the sort of big hairy issues of how network effects work, I've tried to address that already. Increasingly, a lot of the topics that come up might be more topical, things like generative AI, things like Web3. So I've written a couple of things about those. I might write some of those on the Speedinvest blog as well, for example. So generative AI, I wrote about that on the Speedinvest blog. But I really think of breadcrumb.vc as a destination for where you go when you want to learn about network effects. And if people want to... people read that and they want to take the full course, they can come take Applied Network Effects, which is essentially that, but deeper and with sort of real-world exercises you can apply this to. So that's what I think of it as. It's basically a go-to resource for network effects. Hopefully it stays that way and does not become irrelevant. But if it becomes irrelevant, then I have more motivation to write. Then there's something I haven't addressed.
Yeah. And to be fair, to your point earlier, you know, if 70% of the value created by 35% of the businesses were network effects businesses, clearly there is opportunity there. And I think this is probably the other thing, you know, and we'll come on to it on my final kind of question, is because there's a lot of noise around network effects, right? In the sense that, as you said earlier, many businesses, many founders, many investors get it wrong, whether it's virality as opposed to network effects or whatever it might be. That means that the opportunities to create true network effects are limited, right? Depends on the product. And therefore, actually, you know, there will be new use cases for that crop up, which, you know, you will probably study and take new lessons from, right? Because every time, you know, to your point, you know, during the primer, it's not about what the technology is, it's about whether those network effects can be created. And we don't know where those network effects are going to be created. To your earlier point, no one knew that renting out your futon in your room was going to turn into Airbnb, or no one knew that using black cars, you know, would turn into Uber, et cetera, right? So I think I think at the end of the day, we're not moving away from a world of interconnectedness, which is essentially what network effects brings. We're moving towards more connectedness, and therefore there are going to be more and more opportunities for businesses in that space.
This is how I think about it. So essentially, when you look at a business, a lot of people look at the commercial case first, right? How do you make money? How do you do this stuff like that? Behind that is how the users or the customers and the product are connected to each other.
Yeah.
That's the skeleton, and the commercial case is the meat on top. A lot of times, both founders and investors just kind of put meat on it without any bones, and it all falls down, right? You need to create the skeleton first. You need to understand how those connections exist in the first place, how they work. And that's what Breadcrumb VC does. It helps you understand that. Now, over the very long term, does Breadcrumb VC become a fund? That I don't know yet. I still don't know whether that's a good idea or I should join a fund, for example. The trade-offs there are significant. On one end, you have sort of complete autonomy, but you have all of the admin. And
you've got to go out and raise some capital.
And if I'm doing all of that, how much time am I spending with founders?
Mm-hmm.
That's an open question. On the other end, you have less autonomy because not only do you're not making decisions by yourself, you're convincing the firm to be able to invest in a startup, but there is no admin. So at least, or rather, there's less admin.
Less overhead,
yeah. Less admin, less overhead. And so I'm spending more time with the companies that I'm working with and actually making an impact on that business. So that's the trade-off there. I don't have a firm answer for that yet. There's sort of positives on both sides. That's something to keep in mind. That's why I'm not about to say that Breadcrumb VC is going to be a fund for sure. Like, I don't know the answer to that for sure.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And look, I mean, I for one will certainly be keeping an eye on what you get up to there. Just as we sort of wrap up, like, one of the thoughts that I've had, and feel free to like challenge my assumptions on this, is that especially with marketplace businesses, you know, you need to secure quite a substantial part of one side of the marketplace, right? You either need to get significant enough supplies on board that it makes it valuable for the demand side, or vice versa, right? So that essentially to me suggests that marketplaces require a substantial amount of capital to scale either side of that marketplace. Is that correct? And, you know, what is your advice to founders who are building in this space, and especially in this sort of quite significant sort of pullback in the funding ecosystem? How should they be approaching building a marketplace today?
I don't actually, if you're building a true marketplace or a true network, fundamentally you shouldn't require as much capital. You're right that you have the cold start problem in the beginning, but generally that cold start problem is rarely ever solved with throwing money at it.
Got it.
Usually you're trying a hacky way of acquiring users. You go to one set of users and you go, hey, this is going to be really valuable for you. You're selling the promise essentially to them, and then you leverage that promise to get the other side on as well. And so once you solve that cold start problem, as you start to scale, fundamentally it should become easier and easier to scale. Now again, there's quite a bit of diversity within network effects. If it's a hyper-local network effect like Uber, then you're right. Then you need a lot of capital because you're basically solving that in every single city.
Got it.
Like, that's a problem. But if you're Airbnb, like, as you start to scale, the marketplace becomes more valuable and more valuable and more valuable. And so, like, fundamentally, the unit economics have always been extremely healthy because of that.
Yeah, right? Which is why during the pandemic, as an example, they were able to, like, pull back costs really, really quickly and still come out stronger, actually, yeah. Essentially. Yeah.
And so, this goes for most social networks as well. Social networks fundamentally are very, very capital. Like, they don't need a ton of capital. They don't need a ton of employees as well, which is why I'm a bit surprised about how many employees Facebook hired over the pandemic.
Well, they've just sacked, like, whatever.
Pretty much, yeah. You don't need that many.
Yeah,
yeah. Once you kind of build out the business side, then sure, for running your ad unit, you need a bit more there. But for running the product itself, you don't need a ton of employees. So fundamentally, they're more capital light compared to a purely enterprise sales business that needs a massive sales force,
yep.
An inventory carrying business that requires you to actually go and buy inventory.
Working capital and so on, yeah.
There's some software companies that might be lighter, Figma, for example, but Figma, again, is a network. It's not sort of pure SaaS. So yeah, I'd say most network effect companies are fairly capital light.
Yeah. So advice to founders. So, you know, this podcast is called Nothing Ventured for a reason. It's about backing yourself, taking that first step. You've obviously taken a lot of first steps. So, you know, be it, you know, getting into venture, into a startup, and then setting up, you know, breadcrumb.vc and then getting into venture directly. So what advice would you give to anyone who is looking to either build in the network effect space or essentially invest in the network space today? What's the first step that they should take?
The first step is to ask yourself what you're passionate about. I mean, it's always hard to build something new, irrespective of what it is, whether it's small, whether it's going to be big. It's going to be a hard slog. There's going to be days you think you're failing. It's going to be a lot of days you think you're failing.
Yeah.
And at that point, the only thing that's going to keep you going, obviously, one is discipline, which I think most founders need. But also, you need to genuinely care about what you're doing. And if you don't, it's going to be much harder to push yourself. And so this is one reason why I prefer missionary founders over mercenary ones? Like, do you just want to build a company, or do you care about solving a particular problem and why? Kind of, what's the story behind that, behind how you came across that problem? That's pretty important. That founding story takes you a long way. That's one. Second, a lot of times founders go, I need to build this instead in order to please VCs. Like, don't do that.
Yeah.
What VCs like is going to change by the
whatever's turned up today. So, yeah. Now everyone wants to build on ChatGPT 4 or whatever. So,
don't do that. Like, focus on what's right for the problem you're trying to solve. And as long as, you know, the fundamentals behind that product are right, you should be able to build a meaningful business. If the fundamentals behind the product aren't right, so the problem you're solving isn't right, or, you know, the construct of the network doesn't quite work, then you got to think about, okay, how can you pivot this network while still solving that problem you care about? You know, sometimes it might be possible, sometimes it might not be, but at least you're thinking about it the right way. I think that's really important. Don't build for investors. Build for the user, the customer, and for the problem you care about.
Yeah, and I think that's sage advice, not just for network effects, for any business. And I think, you know, a lot of businesses have suffered or failed because they've built exactly as you say for what they expect investors to want, and they've treated the fundraising as a goal rather than creating, you know, a valuable business or a valuable product, and as a result, you know, have unfortunately fallen over. Samir, it's been absolutely incredible having you here in the studio with me today. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. For our listeners, if they're looking for you online, where can they find you? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where can they look for Breadcrumb? What's the best place for them to find
you? I'm everywhere. So if you wanna learn more about Network Effects, go to Breadcrumb VC, or you can search for Applied Network Effects, which is my course. I'm on LinkedIn. You can search for me by my name, Samir Singh. And I'm on Twitter as Samir_Singh17, because unfortunately, Indian names are way too common.
Yeah, they really are. Samir, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Arush. This was fun.